there's an interesting debate I would kind of like you to weigh in on.
Yeah.
You mentioned the 24-hour news cycle, and lately NPR listeners and public radio staff have been talking about the merits of live interviews, because sometimes it can be easy for a politician or someone to come on and say something that maybe isn't factual, but it's difficult for the interviewer to fact check that person. But in the meantime, when you're running a 24-hour news outlet, these interviews can be essential to your product. So what are your thoughts on that subject?
Well, to say that an interview that you can't, that you don't feel in control of and that you don't feel prepared for is part of your, you know, is necessarily part of your product is, you know, it's like the guy who goes to the doctor who says, "Doc, every time I do this, it hurts." And the doc says, "So don't do this." You know, that's the best way to avoid that. I think that it can be very hard to do live interviews because when they're well thought out and planned, you make a kind of a decision tree going in about, I'm going to ask this, what are the likely answers? If he says that, okay, we have, you know, this statement to go with. But you can't have all of the exponential numbers of possible answers that might come up. And if you're not, if it isn't your story, if you don't really know the field well, it can be a losing enterprise, the interview. You can say that. Now, a friend of mine from public radio days, Rick Lewis, I don't know if you remember, used to tell me the definition of an interview is maybe the guest wins. So that's the definition, and that listening to that is engaging. I confess that when I was news director of NPR, I wanted Morning Edition to add a live interview to the show, in part because of efficiencies that. The doing one good, well-done live interview involved a researcher and a host. Recording it and cutting it down involved a producer, an editor, a researcher, and a host. It was, I thought we could just get some good quality material on the air, one item the host could prepare and bone up for and feel confident about. But liveness is not... to me, it's a very peculiar quality in radio, because most people don't seem to have any idea what is live and what is recorded. It's very meaningful on the production end, but I find people to be very surprised when they learn how much is recorded and how little is live. And when I first saw All Things Considered, when I came down looking for a job, two things struck me about it. First, for a thing that sounded very live to me, Susan Stamberg made this thing sound... like it was happening right now. It was the most recorded show I'd ever seen in my life. And second, when the show began, they hadn't yet finished cutting the end of it. And that's, I think, to some extent still true today, that it's a work in progress from the beginning. But a live interview can be tough, and if you're... I think every producer should be asking, how important is it that it be live to so that the guest will react to something that might have been said 1 minute before that? How important is that in the long run? What do we really want to get from this interview? Or are we just saying we want a generic Republican to respond to what a Democrat is? We want a generic Democrat to respond. Those interviews will not be great. It may be okay, but not great.
You know, those of us who have worked in journalism or are trained as journalists, and while we might use different words, I think a lot of us would say the word objectivity as one of the most important aspects of being a journalist. Do you think, from the public's point of view, the general definition or perception of objectivity has evolved or changed over recent years?
Personally, I think much of the public has never believed the idea that journalists don't care that much about the outcome or the consequences of what they do. I think that most people would assume that journalists are not objective. They have a point of view and they want to advance it. So I think that it's important for us to not count on other people validating what we do by their own standards, which might be very different than our own. There's been a growth in blatantly partisan television talk, and although not necessarily reporting, there are, as let's take the, you know, for liberals, the bugbear of Fox News. Brett Baer, Shepard Smith, and Chris Wallace, let's say, are solid. They're solid people. They're straight journalists. They're not in the same business as Sean Hannity. Mm-hmm. Fox would not bill them in the same way, but it's a distinction that's lost on most on most people. But they're they are, I would say, as solid as journalists anywhere else. When we get to the talk shows, that's where I have the problem. Let me put it this way. There's now a tendency to say, we're going to talk about this subject. Let's bring together one of our reporters, a reporter for a newspaper who has a relationship with us, a former federal official who worked in another administration, and some completely partisan campaigner of one sort or another. And the what disturbs me about that is what the reporter is doing in there. Because I look at these discussions and I feel for the reporter who's listening to a highly opinionated conversation, in some occasions rather unfair, you know, it doesn't intend to be fair, it's trying to cheer on a side. And the reporter is trying to maintain some dignity in this, which is, you know, I just report stories here, you know, that's what I do. And I think that the mixing together is a bad trend, and that there has to be some time in the future when we start sorting out a little bit of who sits with whom. You know, what I think I told you this earlier in the day that Daniel Shore, who was a friend and to me a model of many things, was the first journalist Ted Turner hired for what he would then call CNN, and Dan had a falling out with Ted Turner, and it was over staffing him as a commentator for, I think, the 1984 political conventions, when they said, here, we'll team you with John Connolly, and you'll be the two guys who'll talk about the convention. And Dan says, wait a minute, you know, John Connolly is a Republican politician who began as a Democratic politician, former presidential candidate. I'm a journalist. What are you pairing me with John Connolly for? And someone said, well, he's conservative, you're a liberal. And Dan said, well, you know, even if I am liberal, what does that have to do with this? I'm not going on the air to advance any ideas. I'm going on the air to analyze what's said at the convention. And they liked the pairing. So Dan split with CNN and came back to NPR, where he very much wanted a Saturday morning show. I was the news director. I had another idea for a Saturday morning show and put Dan in the middle of it with Scott Simon. What Dan was objecting to, by today's standards, you know, it sounds quaint that he found a problem with this, because the TV talk shows and cable news programs just throw together every different kind of group of people, some of whom have an agenda, some of whom don't, and they like the mix. And I think to me, that's undermining. I don't care about whether the opinion journalists or the ideologues get their say or not, but I don't like the mixing up the reporters with them as if they're just a different kind of ideologue. They're not, and some of them are quite actually very good reporters and deserve better treatment.
I don't know what your experience has been in getting feedback from listeners over the years, but sometimes when taking a particularly passionate call from a listener, I know I found that because those listeners are so passionate about the subject, they have a very difficult time believing that anyone could at least temporarily be dispassionate when they're researching, covering, and reporting a story. Yeah. They just simply don't understand, because of their passion, how someone, you know, could reach that state and do so on a consistent basis.
Yeah, or they might bring great passion to investigating a story and to pushing farther and farther and farther, but in the course of doing it, wouldn't protect people from admissions that might be embarrassing, wouldn't declare something to be unanimous when it was majority, or full when it's only partial. I mean, these are important distinctions, and journalists will take they'll take a hit for it with passionate people. Yeah.
And you, over the years, you've been known for being non-biased and calm and civil, but was there ever an instance where you couldn't hold your composure?
When I couldn't hold my composure.
Yeah.
difficult.
Well, there's a thing called a cough button in a studio. You know,
right?
You can press it, it cuts off your microphone. And with that, I can tell the producer how frustrated I was with any number of interviews that I thought were going badly. I do remember an interview that I was pushing Senator Robert Dole, who was the Republican leader of the Senate, on whether he would veto a Clinton bill. I can't even remember whether it was the health care bill or what it was, which didn't pass, so it couldn't have been that. But would you veto? And I did what you do in a, if this is a recorded interview, it's not live, and I did what a news reporter does when you're questioning someone, which was I essentially asked the same question with slight variations three or four times to push him and see if I could get some motion toward an answer. So on about the third or fourth time, Dole explodes at me, this is on down a line, about I don't know whether I'm going to filibuster that, would he filibuster? And if I knew it, I would not tell such a crazy news organization as National Public Radio screaming at me at the top of his lungs. And once again, as soon as we say goodbye, a producer says, that's fantastic, let's run another. And we did, and I just said, look, here's the one thing you have to do. Look, you can't have him go off like this without hearing me. I didn't assume that all of my three questions would go on the air. I assumed the one that yielded an answer we'd use on the air. But I said, you can't have me just ask him one question and have him go berserk. It'll sound ridiculous. He's reacting to my bothering him. So you got to leave me in bothering him, which we did. And that was a crazy one. There's actually an interview which became quite famous in New Orleans that I did with Alan Chertoff, who is the Secretary of Homeland Security. At the time, I was watching CNN just before the interview, and I saw that in addition to people who had been abandoned in the Superdome, I think, there were people who'd been abandoned at the convention center, I believe that was it. And so when the interview began, and Chertoff wanted to talk about how they'd gotten water to people from Katrina, they'd been isolated, they'd gotten water through in trucks, through flooded streets to people at the Superdome, I asked about the people at the convention center. He said, no, I'm talking about the Superdome. I said, no, but what about the people at the convention center? He said, I think they're not people at the convention center. They're at the Superdome. I said, no, there are people also. I've just seen a film on television. I mean, what's where we sent our reporter, John Burnett, a great reporter, to the convention center to confirm that this was true. And by this time, Burnett is on the phone, and I'm actually hearing Burnett through my headphone, that he's got hundreds of people, they're in the convention center, they've been cut off, nobody's gotten through to them. And Chertoff says, in situations like this, it's very easy for rumors to get out of hand and for people to start getting convinced of things that actually haven't happened because there's so much confusion. I said, look, we've sent a reporter there. I said, he's covered wars in Central America, he's been to refugee camps all over. He's been doing hurricanes since Andrew and Hugo. He's there, and he tells me there are hundreds of people at the convention center. And I said, well, I'm just sorry, but I cannot confirm that. And we stopped the interview. It was like a 9-minute interview or something. And we talked about it, and we said, all right, we're going to, we'll run the 9 minutes. I mean, we've just learned that the Secretary of Homeland Security knows less about what's going on in New Orleans than anybody watching CNN at that moment. It was a terrifying thought. And in fact, when journalists later saw that, later heard it on NPR, this later that evening, I remember hearing this from reporters in New Orleans, and within a day I was down in New Orleans after that. This was when it dawned on us how incompetent the relief effort was. And that night, Brown, the head of FEMA, as in great job, Brownie, went on CNN, and we had, in fact, teed up this interview, and it became clear that nobody knew anything. When I walked out of the studio to my office, the phone rang in my office, and it was a woman who was probably 25 years old who worked for the secretary, and she said, hello, Mr. Siegel, I'm calling from Secretary Chertoff's office, and I just want you to know that as soon as the interview was over, the doors opened up, and people came in and gave the secretary news about the people in the convention center. So, we don't think it's fair for you to run the interview as it happened, since he didn't know that yet. And I looked at the telephone in disbelief, and said, "Look, at the end of the interview, I will say that immediately after our interview, Secretary Chertoff was informed by people, his office tells us he was informed by people that that there were, in fact, people there, but until that moment, he had no idea. And she, I'm being, you know, it's the, this is the moment of the scolding by the government official who is considerably younger than my daughters and is telling me this would be irresponsible to run this. To his credit, Chertoff, whom I would see on occasion elsewhere, well, I remember he once told me, he said, he then launched a major media campaign recovering his image because the interview had been devastating. And but he told me, he said, you know, he said, whenever you dinged me, it was fair. You know, you gave me, I have to say, I never felt I was dealt unfairly by you. And I was very glad to hear that. He regarded that as part of the rough and tumble of being in government and what happens when you get stuff wrong. That you, when you get stuff wrong, you get head up for it. I don't think I would find that spirit from many cabinet secretaries today in the in Washington. So.
Robert, before we go to the audience questions, I know one of the major news events that you were able to cover in depth, almost by coincidence, was the earthquake in China.
Yes.
Perhaps you could describe that to our audience and some of the things you witnessed and how that all transpired when you were reporting from
China. In 2008, all things considered, took advantage of the what I will call the slightly open door policy in China, which was that in exchange for having gotten the Olympic Games, China offered lots and lots of media visas. They were criticized for a dictatorship getting the Olympic Games, so this was their answer. And our show at NPR got the deal. We would go over for a few weeks and produce ultimately pieces for an entire week of coverage from a Chinese city, about life in a Chinese city. And we chose one which would not be terribly familiar to Americans who'd been to China, wouldn't be Beijing, wouldn't be Shanghai. It came down to two in the end, Xi'an or Chengdu, and we chose Chengdu. Many former China correspondents said, it's a fascinating place, it's the capital city of Sichuan province, it's the best food you'll get anywhere in China. As with all journalists, this weighed very heavily in our minds. So we go to Chengdu, a whole, like 15 of us or something, and we start producing stories. I was in my room on the 27th floor of the strangely named Chengdu Lido Sheraton Hotel. I have no idea where the Lido was in Chengdu or why that was its name. And I was watching a video. I had my laptop out. I was preparing for an interview with a Chinese singer, pop singer. Her name was Chris Lee, or her name was Lee something else, yes. But the Chinese very often in English classes choose an English name at some point, and she chose Chris when she was a kid. So she had won. She was in Beijing. She was from Chengdu, but she was actually in Beijing, and our correspondent, Anthony Kuhn, had her at his home studio, and I would interview her from Chengdu. And the reason we found her so interesting was I can't say it was the music. I was. She was a kind of a pop singer. I don't know Mandarin. I was looking at translations. It wasn't my kind of music. But she had won the Manchurian Yogurt Supergirl competition on a Chinese cable channel that had suddenly gone big time because of this program, which was, in a word, the American Idol of China. That's what this was. And so she had been voted the winner by a popular vote of the viewers of this TV show, all over China. Hundreds of thousands of votes, if not a few million votes, are cast in this, which made her arguably the person who had received more votes in a contested election for anything in the history of China than any other person in 5,000 years of Chinese civilization. So I was going to interview her, and I'm watching her music on the on my laptop when I suddenly heard a rather loud grinding noise, and stood up and couldn't quite stand up. I processed this as a really big wind, and then I said, "Wait, now, hotels don't, you know, you don't lose your footing in the wind," and then it hit me: either this is an earthquake or a plane has hit the hotel, which is the sort of thing we've all kept in mind for the past 20 years, I guess. And I ran out of my hotel room, and a passel of staff, hotel staff, simply grabbed me by the arm, and the only thing I could say was thank you. It's the only word I knew, and hello and thank you in Mandarin. And they ran me down the stairs, a run down the stairs, which is, you know, full of considering one's mortality at that moment and thinking, how stupid is this? I've left my passport in the hotel room, and Jane, my wife, is going to, you know, they're going to have to dig for my remains under this building in China. I'm running down. Why didn't I take my passport with me? They could identify me. Got to the bottom, and we learned that this was a 7.9 magnitude quake. We had a couple of crews. Melissa Block, I think, was the superstar of this trip, and went to a school that had collapsed. If you remember what had happened, this happened in the afternoon when all the kids in China go back from lunch break to the afternoon session of school. A lot of schools collapsed, and a lot of school children died, and a lot of parents felt that it was because of the typically shoddy construction produced by typically local corrupt relations between builders and politicians. As Anthony Kuhn and our other, Louisa Lim was then reporting for us from China, they would explain to me there is an almost charming belief among the Chinese that if only the people in Beijing knew what's going on here, this nonsense wouldn't go on. If only the emperor knew what is happening in the provinces, it wouldn't happen. The fact that the people in Beijing came out of the very system was something you didn't hear that often. In any case, over the next couple of days, we were almost the only, the only reason we were there was that we had chosen the city, because nothing happens there. And drove around through areas, villages near the epicenter, and I remember a man describing to me watching a fellow next to him leap off a hospital roof. People, all of whom had stories about losing someone. And I remember going to a small village, a little commune, where we brought in the car, we had our interpreter, we brought water so we could do something for these people. And I was talking with a lady, the stones of their homes had all fallen down and collapsed. And as I was interviewing her through our interpreter, another lady came with a little umbrella to hold over my head, lest I be uncomfortable or get sunburned in the sun. And the extraordinary hospitality of people living in the most wretched moment of their very poor lives was stunning. And I think, you know, part of the thing one comes away from any kind of reporting in China, whether it's a month or, in the case of our correspondence, years and years, is that maybe the biggest change that's happened in the world in the time of our lifetimes is that 200 million, 300 million people, who knows how many, could be more, have moved in China from agrarian subsistence into urban working class lives. There seems to be an unspoken compact between the Chinese people and the regime, which is, so long as you keep this happening, we'll tolerate you making a zillion dollars on the side and running the whole place undemocratically. If that process were to stop at some point, I don't know what would happen, because the Chinese were actually setting records for work stoppages and rather spontaneous protests in those days. So it was a fascinating time, and I think for about a day and a half before order was restored in the sense of the authorities, we had one of the most open views of life in China, in a little piece of China, that Western reporters had been able to get for quite a while, and it was a great opportunity. I would say just one other thing, that when we began the trip, for me it was 2008, and it was a kind of a marker. We announced on the air that we were going to do this, and I think either Melissa or Michelle Norris did an interview with a famous Sichuan cooking chef or something, and we got email about this, and it was email from people who were either in Chengdu or had some connection to Chengdu. We said, we're going to be going there. Mm-hmm. And I'd always thought of the email and the whole web and everything as a means of us communicating things to other people. But within hours of our mentioning that this program would be traveling and doing a lot of reporting from this Chinese city, a whole network of people who were either there or had a best friend there or whatever were in touch with us, and some of them became invaluable to us. One of them was a guy named Xiao Yuxie, who was a piano teacher in the Berkshires in Massachusetts. He was from Chengdu. He'd come here to Interlaken Music Camp as a teenager and then went to the conservatory in Cincinnati. He'd stayed in America teaching piano, but every year went back to Chengdu, loved NPR, and would adjust, I'll adjust my trip back if I can, I can help you. Which was actually useful because the what they call the Sichuan or the Chengdu Hua, the accent, is evidently pretty hard for speakers of standard Mandarin. And Xiao Yu knew the dialect. So we did it was the first foreign reporting trip with a station volunteer that we brought along. And he was my interpreter, and he's a great guy. His green card ultimately ran out, and he had to go back to China a couple of years later. But he was a terrific source of insight into the life of the city. So, and to me, it suddenly realized this thing, this website, this email thing, this we could hear back from people. We could do better stories thanks to all this, and it struck me as a very good idea.
So we have stationed in the audience, stage left, your right, Ben Clemmer, WBOI's All Things Considered host.
Here, here.
And stage right, audience left, Rebecca Green, our news director. They both have microphones, so if you would have questions for Robert, please raise your hand and allow them to get to you with that microphone so that everyone can hear your important question. Who'd like to begin?
Thank you for taking my question. If someone is young in high school or college age and looking to get into the business of journalism and reporting, what guidance would you give them?
There is the always, have you completely given up on medicine question? I have to confess, I did not encourage either of my children to do this. It is, as you said, this is an activity that's always in flux. Right now, the action and the hiring is on the digital side. That is, people who write for the web and who are circulated in a variety of media. And my advice has always been in the past to people. Not to major in journalism was always my advice, which is study history, study literature, do something. The things that you can, you'll be able to learn on a job. You'll learn in a few months a lot of what you would be doing in coursework, but it's important to us also have a sense of what's been going on in the world and why some things are considered more important than other things. So that was always my advice in the past. I think that journalism at the moment is hanging in there. It's a very tough time for newspapers. I mean, we don't know how many newspapers are going to be left. Public radio and the podcasting side of public radio seem to be proliferating. Ironically, the Trump era has been a boon to certain news media. The people have been more attentive to the news. I would say that you should go into it with your eyes open. It's not a profession in which you can get the degree and thereby qualify for a position and then get an advanced degree that qualifies you further. It is, it's all about how good you are at this thing, how energetic and how enterprising you are. And I was talking earlier with Rebecca Green, I think, that it's often said in a very cynical way that in journalism you're only as good as your last story. But the positive side of that is you're as good as your last story. And so if your last story won a Pulitzer, you're in great shape. and I think it's a life that you should probably be prepared to travel. I think when I left New York City for Washington, because the radio station I worked at was sold, and I undertook what for New Yorkers is, as you know, it's just one step before self-amputation or jumping off the Brooklyn Bridge. I was leaving the big leagues to go to the Bush League capital of the United States of America. That was the first smartest thing that I'd ever done in my work life. And fortunately, my wife supported me fully in doing that. And then a few years later, to my complete amazement, NPR, which had no foreign staff at all, said, "Robert, how would you feel about going to work in London since we're beginning this new morning show, Morning Edition, next year, and we better have some more overseas stories in it?" And I thought about it, and we packed up and did it and went. But it turned out to be 4 years. So being mobile, were the two, I think those are the two most important decisions I made in my working life. So you have to follow opportunities and work hard at it.
Thank you for coming. If you had a choice of anyone living or dead to interview, who would you interview?
That's a good question. One of my pastimes since retiring has been reading really long books, and so I read Ron Chernow's biography of Ulysses S. Grant, whom I had grown up dismissing. I had grown up, I think my generation still grew up under the influence of lost cause Southerners, who had presented the idea that, number one, Robert E. Lee was the really great general in the Civil War. And second, it was just everybody in those days was, had benighted views about slavery, and Grant was a drunkard who was just lucky to get in charge of the army. Read Chernow's biography, which I would recommend to absolutely everyone, and Grant emerges as, number one, a brilliant military strategist, maybe the first one using telegraphy to communicate with different armies all across the war, and therefore directing, in effect, an almost continental army, as no one had done before. I also was really quite impressed that during his presidency, he understood exactly what was happening in the South, that the rights of freedmen and women were threatening to Southern whites, and that Southern whites were preventing blacks from achieving the vote and freedom. And counties with thousands of freed slaves would register, a vote total of seven people or something. And Grant did what he could to try to send troops to support the principles of Reconstruction that would have really made for a much more equal country. He had an aide who was a full-blooded Oneida Indian, I believe, a general whose name is now escaping, and probably several of you know who he was. And when they took Lee's surrender at Appomattox, this man, who was a general, was with him, and the look on Lee's face suggested to Grant that Lee thought that they were humiliating him by bringing a black man into this courthouse, to which the man himself explained who he was, and Lee said, "Ah, at least there's one real American here," to which the man who was an American Indian said, "Sir, we're all Americans in here." A moment which, if I had seen in a movie or read in a novel, I would have thought surely some sentimental 20th century person wrote that one up. But there were people who actually believed in what Lincoln had gone to war for, and Grant was an interesting character, so I'd want to interview him. I'm now in the midst of a reading project that makes that look like reading an overnight letter. I've tackled Marcel Proust, and interspersing the volumes of the novel with books about Proust, so it's almost like a course I have for myself, and I'm in the fifth of seven volumes of the novel, so I would be lying if I didn't say I would want very much to interview Marcel Proust, who I think was probably a completely insane interviewee to talk to. So. There's two.
I'd be interested in what do you feel about, with the electronic social media, how that has maybe changed journalism and the concept of being fair and objective and rather neutral in reporting?
It's interesting you should raise that, because when I was in my last few years of working, we were all of us who were hosts of programs and correspondents, were very much encouraged to keep Facebook pages and to tweet. I didn't know why we were encouraged to do that. I felt that if I were to send out messages every day about what I thought about things, I might fire me if I were, you know, if I saw that. And so other of my colleagues didn't have such a problem, but it became a joke on the program, actually, where periodically we were supposed to give our Twitter handles. And before that, I would usually send out a tweet just to show that I had done something once every 3 months. And, and Audie and Ari would make great fun of me at this, that I would give my Twitter handle, which I never used. So I think it's something which I, at some level, I'm going back against the grain of where I walked into this story. Let's say, when I began at NPR in the 70s, it was very novel that journalists would actually speak spontaneously on television. It was more common that they would back up, hold the microphone, and tell us, and that's the way it is today. And they would read a set script, and we didn't expect them to be especially charming when they interacted with one another. We didn't expect them to reveal a tremendous amount about themselves when they did that. While there was a certain honesty to that, there was also a certain boredom to that and sameness. And two things happened that I remember. One was the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, when the NBC correspondents, who were phenomenal, would at the end of covering this craziness of the Kennedy and McGovern and McCarthy forces vying with the Hubert Humphrey forces and a riot in the streets, at the end of the day, they would sit, the four correspondents from the floor, and Huntley and Brinkley up in the rafters, and just talk about what had happened. And I remember the freshness of that. We really hadn't seen people speak spontaneously and describe what they felt about what was going on around them. At that time, public television began Washington Week in Review. And we saw reporters not just working in the formulaic stories that they would file for their newspaper or their magazine, but just talking and sometimes arguing. And it was a great breakthrough. And I certainly was, you know, was very excited about it. I think it's gone to excess. I mean, I think that by now it's considered too important to feel, to experience the humanity of the reporter as opposed to the content of what the reporter has to tell us. And sometimes there are reporters who I think do a great job and their work is very disciplined and very carefully edited. And then they go online and say things in tweets that I find diminishes their professionalism. So I never liked this. I think I'm in the minority about this among my colleagues. But then again, I would say I had enough seniority that I could get away with saying, no, I'm not going to do that. and many of them didn't. So I find it worrying. And I find it, even though NPR pioneered some of these things, the two-way with a reporter as opposed to a scripted story. I think that sometimes in life it's time to for the pendulum to swing back in the other direction a little bit.
Is there any interview that you really were not looking forward to and it surprised you, you enjoyed it so much?
There were a couple, and the one that stuck in my mind was with a novelist, V.S. Naipaul, who was a Trinidadian novelist of Indian extraction and someone whom I had loved reading. I thought he was great. I can't remember. I think he was a Nobel laureate. I can't quite remember. But I got the word from several people when they heard that I was interviewing Naipaul that he was unbearable. He was impossible to interview. This was the most rigid, difficult man, absolutely unforthcoming, and good luck, you know, I said, well, look, I've read his new book, I read all of his books, I mean, I thought he was such a great writer, and I interviewed him, and we had about it originally ran about, you know, went about 30 minutes. It was one of the best interviews I'd ever done or had in my life. And at the end, he was quite forthcoming. I remember he talked about the idea about how the new world for immigrants was a place where people came to lie, that you could make a new life for yourself. You could brush up your family's history and to make them much more elegant in the old country than they were. You made up a new heirs for yourself. And he talked about his little community in Trinidad of Asians from Trinidad. And I remember at the end of the interview thinking, holy cow, I thought this was going to be a disaster, according to everyone. It was a wonderful interview. And he said this thing to me, and I said, thank you, V.S. Naipaul. And he said, Mr. Siegel, thank you very much. It's obvious that you've put a great deal of effort into preparing for this, and I appreciate it a great deal. And so I thought that perhaps that it was spoken. Usually you don't have that conversation with people, but I thought, well, maybe that's why I got a good interview with him. Maybe that had something to do with it. But that when people say that, that's the one that comes to mind for me.
Robert, I know it's been a very long couple of days with travel, but I have one more question for you before we bid all of our friends a good evening. For decades, you've been one of the most eloquent and thoughtful people that I know and have had the privilege of listening to on the radio. And one of the things we do here at WBOI, as well as all public radio stations try to do, is to explain the importance of the listeners as our process and how essential they are to everything we do. So I'm putting the pressure on because of your eloquence, experience, and years of communicating with our audience. Maybe could you, in your own words, just discuss for a moment about the importance of our audience and why they're everything to us?
I like to say that I didn't so much retire from NPR as I took a promotion to the more exalted rank of listener to NPR. The relationship between the people who work at public radio stations like yours and NPR and other public networks, the relationship between them and you is unique in journalism. They're not trying to figure out exactly what kind of car you would likely buy next if they could shift your interest in cars. They're not trying to figure out what you want to do if you're 18 to 48 or whatever it is, 18, and who cares if you're, you know, if you're in some other demographic. They are, in exchange for your support for public radio stations all across the country, they're just trying to do the radio program every day, which is, as I used to say, is the one that I would have listened to if I didn't work there. Because I always figured it's not that there just happened to be 100 smart, curious people in the world, all of whom work at NPR News. You know, there are millions of smart, curious people in America, and a lot of them support a public radio station. To me, that's a very simple, straightforward relationship between listener, supporter, audience, and producer, journalist, host, broadcaster. I think it is a guarantee that you get high-quality stuff and that you get people working as uncynically as I can imagine any broadcast system working, just doing it to put out the best program we can every day. It is the relationship, you know, there are people from commercial media who will have the woman sitting ahead of them in the airport in the plane stand up and say, I recognize you, I'm a great fan. But it's not the same. It's not the same relationship that we feel, in which I think we feel there is an active community in supporting public radio, and it's a community which people who work in it are part of, just like the people who listen to it and who support it. It's with a great sense of gratitude that I have always come to meet people who listen to public radio, because you make this thing happen. We could conceivably come up with some radio format that a gazillion people would listen to for 15 minutes a day, and we could sell a tremendous amount of advertising, but that's not what this is about. It's about guaranteeing an American institution that believes in quality of purpose and quality of execution. So for that, for your support, I think I speak for everybody who works in the system. We're all extremely grateful. Thank you very much for what you do.
And both for his appearance tonight, as well as his decades of public service as host of All Things Considered and all that he's done nationally. Let's give a warm round of appreciation for Mr. Robinson.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. An Evening with Robert Siegel was recorded as part of WBOI's NPR Speaker Series. Special thanks to Sweetwater Sound for providing the audio for this program. Our music is by Mark Waldick and Noah Campodonico. Parts of this show were edited by WBOI intern Lainey Zuver. And thank you for listening.